Accession number 28735, reel 5.
Rickman, reel 5. Could you explain to me how you could taxi the Tiger Moth? Because you mentioned it didn't have any brakes.
Yes, that's right. There was only one problem in taxiing an aircraft. Well, obviously, you have to open the throttle in order to make the propellers turn fast enough to pull the aircraft along, which is what it was doing, the propeller, I mean. And the problem was, which had to be solved, of course, every second you couldn't see, because the tail was resting on the ground, the nose of the aircraft was right in front of your centre of vision. So looking forward, as different from a car, where you can look through the windscreen and see over the bonnet in this case was the front of the engine, which was up in the air, which is why, of course, partly, as soon as you started to roll, to take off, in other words, you picked the tail up. So you could see clearly what was ahead on the runway and, you know, the rest of it. So it's only a matter of swinging the aircraft, if you're taxiing at walking pace or slightly faster, swinging it from side to side so you could see the runway or whatever was ahead, be it vehicles, personnel, you know, whatever.
And you mentioned that you did your first solo and the things that you had to do in the first solo, but how did it feel to do that first solo when you were allowed to fly the aircraft for the first time?
While I was doing it, total concentration on what my instructor had said, what I had practiced, the moves that had to be made at certain times and the degree of movement on the stick and rudder bar and so on to achieve the correct circuit, a sort of an oblong, you see, taking off, turning left, coming back, coming left, checking the speed and landing. Whilst you're doing that, your memory is so full of what did he say, what did I do, what's the correct procedure and so on, and can I match it again and again. Every time you did a circuit, it was the same problem. Until, of course, you do it so often that it becomes second-hand. It's just like driving a car, turning a corner. You don't even think about it now when you've done 50,000 miles or something. But your first time, oh my word, yes, total concentration to a degree where you had no feeling at all. It wasn't until after you got out of the thing and the instructor came up and clapped you on the back or shook hands with you and said, well done, that was 8.5 hours training, that's normal, and that's good normal. If you took 9 hours or more before you were allowed to do a solo, you were a bit behind. Very few chaps cracked before 8 hours. Yeah. 8 hours, 8.5 was dead on average.
How strange was it to get into an aircraft really on your own for the first time?
You didn't do that, actually. You climbed in with the instructor. He did a circuit with you to start with, you see. And then when he'd done it, instead of taking off again, he stopped the aircraft. Just brought it to a standstill. Then he climbed out, touched you on the shoulder and said, right lad, off you go. And off you went. And back you came, fortunately.
So after you'd soloed, I imagine there were a number of other things that you did. You mentioned earlier a little bit about spinning, which I imagine you did with your instructor first. But could you explained why spinning occurred. But could you explain to me how you get out of a spin when you're flying an aircraft?
Stick forward, centralise the rudder bar. That's putting it bluntly. The aircraft is diving, falling, really, left or right, clockwise or counterclockwise. If it's spinning left, then you've got to kick on opposite rudder bar to correct that turn. So you give it full right rudder and the stick forward until it straightened out. Once it straightened out, you could ease back on the stick. So the three moves, in a sense, which would get you out of almost any spin, but not necessarily all. Because there are certain circumstances, particularly if the aircraft were damaged in any way through enemy action, where it was impossible to get out of a spin, and no matter what action you took, and you could take what action I just said, those three movements, to their maximum, stick right forward and full right rudder and stick slightly back or full back, and still you would crash and kill yourself. Yeah. But those were the exceptional circumstances. Normally, in practice, spins, certainly the Tiger Moth, so a very gentle spin and quite regular and so on. You just went round and round and round fairly quickly. One revolution every, 5 seconds, you know. It was a simple matter of doing those three things in the right order. Stick forward first, full rudder, opposite rudder rather, depending on the direction of spin, and then stick back to pull out. It was a similar way because you had to take action in a spin, and action in the event of fire, and action in the event of the propeller stopping in mid-air, which sometimes you could start again by going vertical, and if you got enough height, you could dive fast enough to make the propeller itself start turning again, you see.
Did you practice forced landings at all?
Oh yes, I had to, made to. In fact, one of the first, well, I suppose the prime example for me was in the Tiger Moth. Towards the end of the course, when you've done all the necessary moves and you've done solo cross countries on your own and so on, to this town, to that one, and then back again and so on, you are tested and you have a final test. And you have to pass that with, preferably with flying colours, flying colours, before you can go on to secondary flying. And you have an advanced instructor, not your normal chap who's been teaching you. You say a squadron leader, who's in charge of the station or something, the station commander's final test, you know. Final check, whatever they call it. Called it different things in different places. And in the Tiger Moth, I had mine. I can't remember the chap's name now, but he was certainly an RAF senior instructor. And he took me up, and we went up for, I don't know, an hour, going through all the normal turns and climbs and dives and aerobatics. And one point he said, right, now I want you to do me a slow roll. Now, a roll is turning the aircraft on its side, on its back, and so on. But in the case of the Tiger Moth, it's so light an aircraft and it's got so small an engine that when it gets on its side, suppose you're flying straight and level and you decide to turn left, as it were, roll left. You roll left, right. What happens if you kept the aircraft in that position? Bear in mind that an aircraft only keeps up because the wings provide lift, but not in that position. So what happens? The nose starts to drop. So if when you're at that position, you've got to put the stick over slightly to one side to correct lift the nose up, keep the nose on the horizon. Then you go over another 90 degrees and you're upside down, and you're supposed to check and shut off the petrol because it's a gravity feed. Then you do another 45, and it's the opposite this time, because you're upside down, you're beginning to come like this, and this time you've got to put the stick the other way because keep the nose up to the horizon. So there are minor adjustments going on, quite apart from turning the aeroplane gradually right way through a complete circle. And he said, right, do me a slow roll. So I sort of looked around, there's no other aircraft about, right, okay, here we go. And I went through the whole thing gradually. Because the nose drops or tends to drop and you have to pick it up, you don't really keep on the same level. You tend to just sort of barrel roll slightly when doing it. And I finished the manoeuvre. And he said, that was quite a passable shot of the slow roll, student. But you forgot one thing. I don't think I said anything, actually. I knew he was going to tell me. You forgot to switch off the petrol when you're upside down. I think that was one of the little factors which probably sent me on to bombers, when someone had to decide, was I going on to bombers or fighters? Because I was not at my best when I was upside down. There were other times when this was proved. Some fellows could be upside down and operate, and it didn't worry them at all, made no difference to their flying. But in my case, I was slightly uneasy if I was upside down and my normal world was totally disorientated, you see. And it happened on that occasion, of course. Yeah. Apart from that, we were talking forced landing, strictly speaking. He said, when we'd done this aerobatics, the slow roll, everything else, he said, right, at some point I am going to shut the throttle, close the throttle suddenly, and you must assume that your engine has stopped. You have to do a forced landing. Do a forced landing. Now, my normal instructors had told me what to do. You, as you're going along, you have to try and be aware by whatever means which way the wind's blowing. Because you've got to try and land into wind if you can, keep the rate down and the damage less. So you watch out for the trees being blown over or smoke coming out of the chimneys, whatever you can to say, I'm flying here, but the wind's that way, therefore I need to find a field big enough to land in, flat enough to land in, without any hazards, people, cattle, and make the right approach. Well, how high am I now? 5,000 feet? Well, you know, look around. So I looked around, and the thing I remember my ordinary instructor saying, what you must not do, but never, never undershoot. That is to say, to come in too low and hit the hedge that you're trying to clear to get onto the field, see? So I looked around, I figured where the wind was, I picked out a patch of a field down there to the right, and I did a long turn around towards it and got downwind of it at 1,000 feet, say, and started to lower the plane heading for this field. I looked around, I didn't see any big trees from 5,000 feet. As I was approaching the field, say, quarter of a mile away, perhaps a bit less, I imagine, I saw to my horror that the far end of the field, where I was aiming for, which I'd, from 5,000 feet, looked like a hedge, suddenly became a 20-foot high row of poplars, like this. And I was already, because I didn't want to overshoot, I was already 20 or 30 feet above the hedge I was coming over, and I was coming down. And I knew damn well by that time that I could not land in that field, but of course, forced landing, you had to. So I thought, can I get down as low as possible? No, I can't. I was still doing too fast, and the trees were coming up at me too fast. So I thought, oh, well, I'm sorry. The thing to do is to open the throttle fast and pull up away from the trees. But I couldn't push it forward. He was holding it back. And for about 3 seconds, what's going to happen? The trees were getting closer and closer. We were about 10 feet off the ground, maybe 15, going, I don't know, 60, 70 miles an hour. And he wouldn't let me push the throttle. And suddenly he said, "I've got her." And we were about to crash into those trees. We weren't, just across the other side of that road, you know, less than 50 yards. "I've got her," he said. And he opened the throttle and he turned the aircraft on its side and he went sideways between two poplars. I was dumbfounded. God, the sheer brilliance of thinking of doing a thing like that to get through that sort of space had never occurred to me. And I didn't say a word. And he said, when we just straightened up and got a bit more high, he said, "Thing you must never forget, never overshoot." See, somebody says, never undershoot, someone else says never overshoot. They're both right, yeah. But getting it right in the middle is not an easy matter. Nevertheless, it was an experience which I relate to you now, just as in answer to your question, did you practice the forced landings? Yes, of course. But I never thought that it would, in fact, that particular one, have repercussions in a later date in real action, which I'll tell you about later.
You mentioned you did cross countries as well during that period.
Cross
country flights.
Yes, yeah.
Could you explain the sort of technique for doing that? You know, how you would navigate, how you would get from one point to another point, the kind of very basic principles that you were learning during that period.
Yes, it's, this will involve, of course, pilot navigation. In other words, because you're flying solo, you don't have an observer sitting behind you with a map and a chart and working out where you are and so on. You have a small map, just like the ordnance survey maps. Would have been one of those, possibly strapped onto your knee. Otherwise, there's a chance that you might have had to make an adjustment to the aircraft and it might have fallen down on the floor. So having it strapped here, and you would have made possibly some mark on it, as to what to look for in the way of landmarks. Cross countries normally were intended to check your ability at pilot navigation. So consequently, there's not much point in doing them at, say, 5,000 to 10,000 feet. It's low-level cross country is a normal thing. Why? Because it is difficult to see the map. You're going over the ground so fast that you've got to watch for landmarks. So, and you've got to watch out for pylons, chimneys, you know, whatever. So rivers, railways were always very good things to have. They were easy to follow, easy to see, bridges in particular, towns, of course. And it's a matter, therefore, depending on the conditions, day or night, dark or lightness, cloud or rain or whatever, trying to go from A to B to C to D to E to F and back to base, having had to look for visual landmarks to enable you to fly really a definite course. Sometimes it was easy, sometimes it wasn't so easy, because some places have a dire shortage of landmarks, yeah. And you fly over grass fields and trees and grass fields and trees, and where the hell am I? And it's all grass fields and trees and no church spires or whatever, you see. But if you've got big objects like power stations or you know, factories, then you tend to be able to cross country fairly easily. All a matter of height and availability of reference points, yeah.
While you were at Eldon, did you do any night flying?
We must have done. I suppose. I'm not sure, but we must have done. But I don't remember it, funnily enough. No. Duel.
So you did some night flying at last
three, time? Three, probably about three flights of about an hour each with an instructor. But not on my own, not solo. That's right.
What was the obvious problems of night flying?
That you can't see the horizon. Depending on the night too. But if it was a total night flying, yeah, then you have to fly on instruments. And as I was telling you yesterday, instruments are always right, and you and your senses are often wrong in certain circumstances. So you have to be able to judge and to rely on your instruments. And therefore, at night, the best thing to do to practice for it is don't do it at night, because there were certain tiger moths, if not all of them, in training, which had a hood that came over the front cockpit. So the instructor could sit in the back in the daylight, and the hood was pulled over, and you couldn't see anything except your instruments and a little aeroplane, the artificial horizon, as it was called, which tells you what your attitude of the aircraft is, up, down, left, right, and centre. So yes, we did a little night flying, but we did far, far more on the Harvard in secondary flying out in Canada. No.
Was it easy to trust your instruments at first?
Not at first. Yeah, you had to get used to it. No. I'm trying to think whether there's any corresponding characteristic in learning to drive a car, but I don't think there is. No. You, because in a car you're limited to two dimensions, forward and sideways, you might be skidding or turning, but you can normally see by day, probably by night, because you carry headlights, whereas an aircraft doesn't. You can probably see what's happening vis-a-vis yourself, the plane that you're in, where it is, what it's doing. Just as I said, there is a lesson to be learned that under certain circumstances, and not many of them, unfortunately, you must not believe your own senses. You must believe what you see on the instruments. Yeah.
Now, you've done all this training, and you mentioned obviously there was a test at the end of it. Had there been a failure rate amongst your sort of fellow pupils during this elementary
training? Oh yes, oh yes. Well, not a failure rate as such, because all the personnel, usually pilots' courses were about 30 strong, and you moved to from elementary to secondary, and from secondary to Navy or Air Force advanced flying. There were advanced flying units, depending on what work you were going to do with which aircraft. But all the pupils that were sent on a course completed the course, carried on with the training, regardless of whether they had a crash or whether they were airsick, as some were, particularly on tiger moths. I remember two chaps who were dipped, as we say, at the end of the course because of continual air sickness, for example. And there were others who did really naughty things, but naughty, well, just lack of concentration. I remember in Canada, actually, I think it was the first evening night, attempt at night flying. Well, half a dozen of us and one Harvard, and each of us took it up for a few minutes doing circuits and bumps for 10 minutes, and then another changes over and so on. Number four went up and took off. We had these retractable undercarriage, you see, so it was first thing you do when you get off the ground is undercarriage up to increase the speed and airworthiness and so on. And then when you come round on the circuit, of course, you've got to go through a UMPF, undercarriage, pitch, flaps, and so on, you know, depending on the aircraft. There was a regular little routine of letters, capital letters, U for undercarriage, M for mixture, P for pitch, and so on, which had to be done depending on the aircraft. And this chap took off in the middle of a Canadian winter night, in this bright yellow Harvard. We got some light on the runway lights, of course, were on the ones you land with and between. But there was a hut there and a number of us standing around. And he took off and he came in to land. And he forgot to put his wheels down. Now you might think, oh well, he just forgot to put his wheels down. When I tell you that in the Harvard, behind the pilot's right ear, there is a horn. And if you close that throttle and the undercarriage is knocked down, that whole blasts like a giant taxi horn. He's right in your right ear. And in spite of that, he landed with it. And when he climbed out of the aeroplane, and when he came over to where I was standing with the instructor and so on, I have never seen a chap with so red a face. It was absolutely tomato red, you know. He could hardly speak. He was so embarrassed. And finally dipped, of course, you know. Went through the training, but no, sorry. Too many crashes, too many mistakes. It happened. But not until after the course was finished.
So what happened at the end of the course at Elmden with you? What was the procedure for the end of the course, and what happened next?
An entry was made in your logbook as to your ability in flying in certain aspects of it, and any particular flying faults that were persistent that you tended to have all the time were noted down by the chief instructor of the station where you were training. So there was a sort of report made about you and your progress. A series of just numbers entered, one out of ten, you know, five is average, six, seven and eight are sort of above average, nine and ten are exceptional, unsatisfactory, below four down to one. Therefore, what happened was you didn't know about this. This was your logbook was just handed in at the squadron office, and the leader, the chap commanding the station, whatever it is, or in charge of your particular course, went through them all and made this entry. They're all in there, you see. And I got they normally wrote average, and when it came to the more advanced stages, like torpedo work or bombing and things of that sort, they would say average should make an average operational pilot, you know. I got an average good, actually, which he wrote good in afterwards, which meant that it wasn't really quite good enough to call it above average, but it was slightly better than average. And this was mainly for night work, because I was always better at night than I was by day, and still am. Yeah. Why? It's a matter of just the blood temperature, I'm told. But nevertheless, it meant that with night flying, which later I did with some success after D-Day in the Channel, even actually when I was in Canada, I remember my Don Greenhow, my Canadian instructor, saying, "I don't understand you, Rickman," he said. You seem to have to fight the Harvard down. This is trying to land here. Fight the Harvard down onto the runway by day, and yet when we come and fly at night, you just put it down as sweetly as anything. No trouble at all, he said. Other people are the reverse of that. I said, I'm sorry, Sergeant, I don't know why I just do it. It just suits me. I'm much happier with two rows of lights, which are pointing upwards and gradually become level. I can operate with that, and I do. And so my night flying was one of my major successes of wartime flying, but that comes later.